We talk a lot about forest products in our part of the world. When you're surrounded by big forests, as we are, you can't help it. But the term forest products tends to focus on the woody stuff, the kind that requires a chainsaw to cut and a big truck to remove. There are other products in the forest, to be sure. Those include mushrooms. Ounce by ounce, they can be a lot more valuable than the trees they grow near and on. There's so much to know about mushrooms near us, and today's guest can help us with an introductory course of sorts, Roger Fingers with the Oregon Mycological Society. Roger, thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Tell us a bit about the society and what mycology means, why mycology is used to describe mushrooms.
Well, the Oregon Mycological Society was founded in 1956, and it's approximately 650 members in the greater Portland area, but we also have members up and down the valley and east and west to the coast. Our mission is to bring together people who have an interest in mycology. Mycology, of course, is defined as the study of fungus, and there are a lot of different types of fungi. For example, molds and yeasts and slimes and, of course, mushrooms. It's not a very well-understood kingdom. It is a kingdom equivalent to plants and animals, and there are many thousands of genuses in this kingdom, but there's also many thousands that we haven't yet cataloged. So in this era of scientific discovery, we're still learning about mushrooms.
That's really interesting. I forget that from time to time, that we were talking about a separate kingdom here, not quite plants, not quite animals. What makes fungi so different from both?
Well, fungi generally don't have photosynthesis, so they can't produce energy all by themselves. They tend to form symbiotic and parasitic relationships with plants and trees and decaying matter. One really interesting characteristic of fungi is that they are composed of chitin. Chitin rather than cellulose. If they were cellulose, they'd be in the plant kingdom, but chitin is also the stuff that insects are made out of, so there's an argument that fungi are actually closer to animals than plants.
Interesting. And how does one get interested in this sort of thing? What spurred you to get involved in mycology?
Well, I came to the Pacific Northwest about 35 years ago, and for the first 25 years of my time here, I spent a lot of time in the woods. I enjoy the recreational opportunities we have in the Pacific Northwest, but I never once saw a mushroom that I recognized as being edible. Part of that was education, but the real reason that didn't happen is because I spent most of the time on a trail. You have to get off the trail in order to get into the better mushroom areas, and that in itself presents issues because, well, once you're off the trail, you're responsible for your own survival. So it definitely takes some wilderness skills and some good navigating skills in addition to your ability to recognize and identify edible mushrooms.
All right, so we're talking literally off the beaten trail. Is it because the places where people walk are not the kinds of places where mushrooms tend to grow, or have they stomped them down, or what's the factor there?
Yeah, that really is a factor. Foot traffic will definitely discourage mushrooms, and people that know mushrooms that are walking on those same trails will probably pick them up along the way. So the trails are the least likely place to find the mushrooms. You want to go away off the beaten trail and start looking under things and behind things and in all sorts of areas that you wouldn't normally be looking.
I noticed that there are so many websites out there if you type mushrooms into a search engine, and it usually helps if you type minus magic so you don't get those references. We'll get into that later. But websites not just about finding mushrooms in the woods, but also growing mushrooms. I mean, in the Oregon Mycological Society, you're mostly about the wild mushrooms?
It is. And various members have different interests. We have scientific-oriented people, the real mycologists of the group. And they're a tremendous resource. It's one of the reasons why I joined the Oregon Mycological Society, is to learn from these people. They're the ones that get on the microscopes, identify the spores, know all of the taxonomy, and are able to recite Latin names like it was second nature to them. But there's also smaller groups that are interested in things like making vegetable dyes out of mushrooms. Most of us enjoy edible mushrooms. The organization offers forays into the forest. We have regular monthly meetings where we get very interesting speakers to come in and tell us about their experiences. And we're coming up to one of my favorite events of the year. OMS members are invited to a survivor's banquet where mushrooms that have been collected previously in the year are served up in all sorts of delicious food dishes.
I noticed the reference to survivor's meeting at the Oregon Mycological Society website and wondered why it's called that.
Oh, well, we are all survivors. I don't recall any poisoning incidents within the membership, but of course they do happen probably every year. And it's mostly amateurs that go out in the woods and see something that looks like something they know, but really it's not.
How close can it be? I mean, are there two kinds of mushrooms, for example, that look, you know, to the untrained eye very much alike, but one is poisonous and the other isn't?
Absolutely. There are lookalikes for almost every edible mushroom, and I've got a few guidelines that'll be helpful. First of all, if you're a beginner, you should probably avoid all mushrooms that have gills. Gills are those parallel structures underneath the cap of the mushroom, and there are certainly gilled mushrooms that are quite delicious, but those are the ones that tend to have poisonous lookalikes. The spined mushrooms and mushrooms that have ridges, like chanterelles, those are much easier to identify, and therefore your chances of finding the right mushroom are better. There are certainly some poisonous mushrooms that people should be aware of. For example, all Amanita species, these are the very large red mushrooms. They have a veil underneath where the cap was connected to the stem. They have an egg-shaped sac, and most often they have warts on top. These are definitely poisonous, and you don't want to mess with them.
All right, well, we'll pick it up on the other side of a break. We've got more to learn about mushrooms with Roger Finger from the Oregon Mycological Society. We're talking about mushrooms in the woods around us and how we can tell them apart and some of the other bits of information that just make looking for mushrooms, whether you eat them or not, really interesting. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Roger Finger and your phone calls and emails in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. We're talking mushrooms with Roger Finger from the Oregon Mycological Society, learning about fungi in many different varieties out there in the woods. Some are tasty, some are deadly. We're trying to tell them apart, and we're finding out more things about mushrooms and what interests people about them as they head off into the woods. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange with questions or comments, 800-838-3760, 800-838-3760, or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So we're talking about telling the tasty and the deadly apart. Avoid all mushrooms with gills if you're new at this. The spined and ridged are going to be a little better for you. And all Amanita species, you say, are poisonous. In fact, isn't there an Amanita species called death cap?
Amanita muscaria, Amanita panthera. There's quite a number of them. And there is one edible Amanita, but unless you're an expert, I would not attempt it.
How long had you been involved in looking at fungi before you felt confident enough to just pick something up and say, yep, this is it, I'm going to eat it?
Well, as I said, I spent 25 years on the trails before I finally found a friend of mine who was willing to take me out and show me a chanterelle patch. And from the moment I was out there with her, I was hooked. This was about 6 years ago, and every season, spring and fall, I'm out there in the woods looking for mushrooms. So, if you have somebody that knows their way around and has done it before, and can take you into an area that is productive, that's always a really good way to start.
Let's take a call. We have Jeannie in Medford on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Roger Finger. We're talking mushrooms.
Oh, great. Encapsulate, Jeannie. In Germany, they always have a mushroom on the Christmas decoration, and the thing they call it a fairy circle, that's probably the hallucinogen, if I could pronounce it. My real question is about the boletus. I lived in Siskiyou Forest, and the king queen boletus, I think, was good to eat, but the Sentinus, I believe, was not, and they all looked very similar.
All right, Boletus. That's it's one on the list of things that that Roger has here. Thanks for the call.
Oh, good. John. Thank you.
All right, take care. So, Roger,
yes.
Go ahead.
Boletus are definitely one of the ones we're looking for. They have a lot of different names, Porcini in Italy, Steps in France, Kings in the UK and the US. But in general, we're looking for Boletus edulis, which is one of the larger species. It's a nice tan color. It's a very handsome mushroom. And it's identified, among other things, by a spongy material underneath the cap. That's characteristic of all boletes. However, there are a lot of boletes, and many of them, while not poisonous, are not tasty and perhaps would give you an upset stomach. So this is where it really helps to have a good field guide. The field guide will instruct you to look at characteristics of the mushroom. For example, is the stem striped or stippled? What's underneath the cap? Is it that spongy material? Is the cap slimy or dry? Does it have a veil? And these are the identifying characteristics that help us arrive at a conclusion that, yes, this is Boletus edulis, and we definitely want it.
Do a lot of these mushrooms require actual removal from the ground before you can get close enough to figure out whether it's safe to eat or not?
I would say so. That is, if you think you've got a match, go ahead and pick it. By picking the mushroom, it's similar to picking the fruit off a tree. It does not hurt the tree. It does not hurt the mushroom. Underneath the ground is where the rhizomes are. And this is the essence of the mushroom. It'll form new mushrooms the same year, and it'll certainly come, in most cases, come back the next year. So it's okay to pick them as long as it's something that you have an intention of using. When I see a non-edible mushroom, unless I'm collecting specimens, I'll leave it in the ground just from an ecological standpoint because it's a living thing, and it deserves to remain in its habitat.
Roger Finger, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking mushrooms. He's with the Oregon Mycological Society. So, Boletus, one of the items that people are looking for when they go out in the woods, as I look at the list of things that people are looking for, it seems like we often compare mushrooms to other edibles or at least other living things because, for example, we've got gypsy mushrooms and oyster mushrooms and hedgehog mushrooms.
Right. Of course, those are the common names. They have Latin names by genus and species, which are much more accurate. But in common parlance, the English language names are typically what we'll use. I don't really have a good reason why they're named that, with the exception of perhaps two of those you mentioned. The cauliflower mushroom actually does look like a cauliflower. It has a very wrinkled surface. It's a large mushroom, and it's that creamy white color you might expect a cauliflower to have. The lion's mane is kind of this spiny mushroom that grows on wood, and it looks like a beard. So at least in those two cases, they're very well named.
So when you go out in the woods in particular, Roger, I mean, what are the ones that you're most often looking for, and what are the seasons of the year when they are found?
Right. I'd have to say chanterelles in the Pacific Northwest are definitely the primary collectible edible mushroom. There are about a half dozen different varieties, but they all share common characteristics. If you have ever seen one, you might see them in the supermarkets now. They're typically orange or tan. They're fairly large. They have the ridges that run down the stem from under the cap. And they're quite delicious. But the ones we see in the supermarket are not the only ones you're going to find out there. There's also a white chanterelle, which is a little bit blockier and meatier. Doesn't have as much of a cap. And there's a rose chanterelle, which has an intense yellow color. And then there's a winter chanterelle, which is much more delicate and smaller. So there's quite a bit to choose from.
How long does it take any of these to grow from, do they start with spores and then grow into full-fledged mushrooms? And how long a process is that?
Well, it varies. varies quite a bit by species. Some of them can be incredibly rapid. I don't have an exact answer for you on that, but I know that in the case of boletes, you can come back to the same patch within 48 hours and find new mushrooms that you didn't see 2 days before.
Wow, that is fast. And so chanterelles, and what are the usual places they are found? I mean, do they tend to cluster around certain tree species, certain types of ecosystems, moister, darker, whatever?
Yeah, that's a really good point, and that will determine your success as a mushroom hunter, is how good you are at tree identification. In our part of the country, chanterelles are associated with conifer trees, so the Doug firs and the spruce, the hemlock trees would be a good place to look. You're looking for a forest area that has a nice layer of duff underneath it. It might be covered with ferns, or it might have salal, but you want to look underneath all of the plant cover down in the forest duff, and that's where you'll find the chanterelles. The two areas that most people go to and are in the Willamette Valley would be the Coast Range and the Cascade Mountains. They vary based on times of year. The season tends to progress downward, starting at the high altitudes and moving down toward the coast. But the coast also gets an early season thanks to the fog that comes in. So what you're looking for is a dark forest. It doesn't have to be old growth. In fact, second growth is probably a better place to look. But you want to make sure that it's got the right kind of trees, because that provides the nutrients that these mushrooms need in order to grow.
Do the mushrooms tend to grow as numerous in places where there's already been logging, for example, when there's been a clear cut and the forest has regrown? Single species plantations, I guess, is what I'm asking about.
Sure. Well, clear cuts are generally not productive, with one exception, which I'll talk about in a moment. That second growth is really a good place to look. It could be a tree plantation, although if it's been intensively managed, that means that there's been machinery and fire and people walking through it, disturbing the soil. Some mushrooms actually thrive on disturbed soil. So it really depends on the species as to how much human intervention that they'll tolerate. The exception that I mentioned a moment ago is with the morels. There are five species of morels available to us. Two of those grow along riverbanks, but the other three really prefer burnt areas. So in the case of morels, what you're looking for is an area that has had a forest fire within the last 1 to 2 years.
And is it because something chemically going on in the soil that helps their growth?
Well, we believe the fire probably activates the spores and provides the carbon resources they need in order to grow.
We're talking to Roger Finger at the Oregon Mycological Society about mushrooms and mushroom hunting. So many mushrooms, so little time. But you can get your questions or comments in here and ask about things that you are looking for, things that you might have noticed as you've been out and about in the woods noticing mushrooms. 800-838-3760 around the region. 800-838-3760 to join the conversation. Or send an email to jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from John in Veneta. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Roger Finger.
Good morning, guys.
Hi.
Roger, do you remember a fella named Gary Minzer? Back in the 80s?
Roger Minzer was
that? Not immediately. Gary Minzer.
Uh-huh. Gary Minzer.
All right, so what's the question?
Well, the question is I'm just curious... Callison Shrub Company, or whatever they called themselves, they were dealing with like huckleberry and that kind of thing, and it was using a lot of funeral stuff. And it was a dying industry at the time, and the company, their head was up in Seattle, they decided they were going to start collecting chanterelles because they were coming on pretty strong. And Gary got involved with that. He was self-taught mycologist and traveled all over the country doing this stuff. It's weird. I was a scout. I took him out in the woods. He showed me a picture. I go take him to it, and I didn't know what it even was. But anyway, it was the Callison Mushroom Company, and supposedly we moved like the second volume of wild collectibles at that time, say 84. And I was wondering, it just seems like it's dropped off. I don't see the people out there doing it. I was just wondering what's happened with that kind of wild foray.
Thanks for the question.
You're really talking about commercial collectors, and they have not dropped off, if anything. They've become much more common. Of course, there's an economic incentive, but if the popular demand for these mushrooms by restaurants and by individuals, we're learning how to cook them into some very delicious dishes that's driving the whole industry. And now, I dare say, if you go to any major supermarket, you'll notice that there are all sorts of wild mushrooms. Some of them are perhaps farmed mushrooms. For example, oyster mushrooms are mostly farmed at this point. But chanterelles have resisted that. We just don't know how to propagate them in vitro. And so they have to be collected, and there's quite a number of people out there collecting them. It's a very interesting industry because it's mostly underground. It's performed largely by immigrants. The buyers go out to these trailheads, meet up with the collectors. They do a cash business, and they rush them back into the cities where we enjoy them in our markets.
So these are people who are collecting for money, and in pretty some cases, pretty good money, it sounds like. What are the regulations on? They're paying some permit fees to go out in the woods in the first place, aren't they?
Yes. Most public lands do have permits required, and commercial permits are much more expensive than the recreational permits. In most cases, the recreational permits are free. But there are areas where they cannot collect. Doesn't mean they don't collect there, but there are quite a substantial number of regulations on this industry.
Can it get kind of interesting in the woods for the folks who are not doing it commercially? Are they running across commercial pickers, and are there any conflicts out there over the mushrooms?
Well, occasionally there are, and we've heard stories about mushroom pickers carrying guns, but I think those are quite inflated. I personally don't know of any hostile encounters of that nature. But what you will see is people jumping claims or thinking that they own a patch, or going in there and cleaning out an area before the recreational guys can get in there. So there is definitely competition for this resource, and the commercial guys are far more efficient at it than the recreational people.
Is there a risk of the forest being denuded of mushrooms? I mean, as long as they don't disturb what's underneath, I mean, I suppose mushrooms can still grow, but you know more about this than I do.
It's a very abundant resource at the moment. Any area can certainly be subject to over-collecting, and then that patch may or may not come back. But the mushrooms are quite robust and resilient, and they do tend to come back year after year as long as you don't really disturb the environment. One caution I should mention is, for example, Matsutake pickers. Some people use rakes, and I consider that to be abhorrent because the raking does disturb the mycelium. So my advice to listeners would be to be considerate and careful with your environment, and it will continue to reward us for years to come.
The mycelium is the matrix in which the mushrooms grow?
Correct.
Okay, let's take another call. We have Bob in Fieldbrook, California. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Roger Finger. We're talking mushrooms.
Thank you.
Sure.
I have a quick question about pulling the mushrooms versus cutting the mushrooms. And what does that do to the mycelium layer?
Yes, that is actually a raging debate. Cutting seems like it would be more conservative. However, when you leave a stem in the ground, that provides an entry point for insects and other kinds of parasitic organisms. Pulling a mushroom, if you carefully remove it from the ground, separates it from the mycelium in a way that does not disturb the mushroom. However, then you've got this mushroom with a dirty stem on the bottom, and if you put that in your bed, you're going to pollute the rest of your mushrooms with dirt and make the cleaning task that much more difficult. So me personally, I very carefully wiggle them around and remove them from the ground and then cut off the dirt end of the stem.
So it's a two-part process. Once it's actually gone pop and gotten out of the mycelium, you then cut off the dirty end.
Yes.
So what else is in your gadget bag, Roger, when you head off into the woods to look for mushrooms? What sorts of tools and accoutrements do you bring with you?
Well, that's a great question. So assuming that you know the area you're going, I would hope that you'd have a compass, know how to use your compass as well. You would need a knife, because we cut mushrooms and we separate them. You'll have a bag, and this will be typically like one of those reusable grocery bags or a wicker basket, but definitely not a plastic bag. Plastic bags don't allow the mushrooms to breathe, and they become slimy pretty quickly. So by the time you get home, the quality will have suffered. A lot of people bring GPS units with them. They're really excellent, but they don't always work under heavy tree cover. And if that's all you're relying on to get you back to your car, you better bring some spare batteries. Other considerations would just be common sense, like a good pair of waterproof hiking boots, perhaps some waterproof pants, a nice towel that'll keep you warm, and a little bit of food and water in case you do get lost, so that you have the ability to get back at some point in one piece.
All right, let's talk about the process. If people do get lost in mushroom hunts, we'll talk to Roger about that and about much more, not just about the hunting, but about the mushrooms themselves. He's with the Oregon Mycological Society and our guest. We'll take more phone calls and emails if you'd like to visit. Back on the Exchange in a minute five. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. We're talking about mushrooms, not the kind you buy in those little baskets in the store. Well, maybe not, unless they're grown in the wild, because that's generally what we're talking about here, mushrooms that grow out in the woods, and people like Roger Finger from the Oregon Mycological Society go out and find them. A lot to know here about telling the good apart from the deadly, and about the whole process of going to get mushrooms from the woods. Join us on the Exchange with questions or comments for Roger, 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area, 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. We were just talking about GPS systems and batteries and, of course, keeping food and water with you. You mentioned you'd been out on trails for probably 25 years, I think, and for several years before you started looking for mushrooms. So have you ever gotten a situation where you weren't quite sure where you were in search of mushrooms?
Yes, I definitely have. Fortunately, I was not lost for very long, but there are some common sense precautions to take, and we didn't quite have time before the break to finish out the list of things to bring. One of the things I will definitely bring with me is a mushroom identification book. I know the edibles that I'm looking for, but I'm always finding new mushrooms, and I want to know what they are. So that's handy. I should also mention a whistle. Now, assuming that you're always going out with a partner or several people, the whistles will help you stay as a group, and that has tremendous survival benefit. You can go 100 yards in the woods and no longer see your partner, but if you've got the whistle, there is a code that's generally accepted. It's a signal that helps us find each other, a lot like birds or other animals find each other with a particular call. So if I give one blast of a whistle, I'm asking, where are you? And I expect you to answer back, typically with one blast. Two blasts I use to say, hey, I found something. Other people use that as a here I am message. But three blasts of the whistle is always, I need help. And that means we go to that person and figure out what exactly is going on.
So don't toot the whistle three times unless you're serious about having a problem.
Well, you're going to attract your partners, yes.
All right. Let's take some more calls. We have Pam and Dexter on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Roger Finger from the Oregon Mycological Society.
Hi. Well, I'm a big fan of Paul Stamets and his Six Ways Mushrooms Can Save the World, and which you can find on YouTube. I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about mushrooms' role in the forest, because I've heard it's pretty critical. And what happens when it's disrupted, either through logging or whatever? I'm going to the talk tonight in Roseburg on the Jordan Cove LNG line, and I know that's going to potentially disrupt a lot of old growth forests if they do pass that. And I know mushrooms play a key role in the forest, especially the native forests or the forests that haven't been cut. So So if you could talk about that a little bit, I'd really appreciate it.
All right. Thanks for the call, Pam. Appreciate it.
That is a really excellent point. And Paul Stamets is one of my heroes. He has really been instrumental in educating people about not only the ecological role of mushrooms, but also the medicinal opportunities that mushrooms offer. Let's take the ecological role first. Mushrooms are decomposers, and if it wasn't for mushrooms, we wouldn't have this carbon cycle that's so essential to forest growth. So every time you're out there and you step on a rotted log, that log is probably rotted because something is living in it. Whether it's a sizable mushroom that you can see or just a mycelium that have infiltrated the mushroom, that's what's going to decompose it back to the forest stuff. Mushrooms are also part of the food cycles for various wild animals out there. Deer eat them, squirrel eat them, all sorts of wild animals include mushrooms in their diet. And then we really don't know all of the health benefits from mushrooms, but Paul Stamets says that they cure cancer, they can improve our immunity, and they provide good nutrition for us as well. So mushrooms are a pretty important part of the ecology.
Let us take another call. Here's Paul in Central Point. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Roger Finger from the Oregon Mycological Society.
Well, Roger, I was wondering if you had some recommended field guides for mushrooms. I currently use the Demystifying Mushrooms book. I forget the author's name, but I'm sure there's others out there.
All right, yes. Good field guides. Thanks for that, Paul.
The Mushrooms Demystified is written by David Arora, and that is one of our Bibles for identifying mushrooms. You might also consider a smaller field guide also put out by David Arora called All That the Rain Brings, and that has excellent color plates and is it has almost all of the edibles that you're likely to be looking for, as well as quite a number of common mushrooms in the Pacific Northwest. Now, as we're talking about field guides, it's important to know that a field guide for the East Coast will not be the same as the West Coast. They may have the same species, but they'll look completely different because of the host environment and because of evolutionary drift between them. So in the Pacific Northwest, the two David Arora guides are excellent. Pacific Northwest Mushrooms by Steve Trudell is very good. And the Audubon Society also publishes a very nice mushroom guide with excellent color plates.
Here again, I want to be clear. Do you recommend, Roger, that people do go out with the field guides and somebody who knows mushrooms as well before they start making any assumptions about what's edible and not?
I would say yes. The reason is even the experts get stumped occasionally. But just because there are so many different species out there and so many different variations in nature, it's always good to have a guide with you.
So what exactly is going on with the growth of mushrooms? We tend to think of them, I think, as individual organisms, but in fact, what actually grows out of the ground is just part of a larger organism then, isn't it?
They can be very large, in fact, and this brings me back to your earlier comment about, well, where do you find them, and are they solitary or colonial? The fact is, many mushrooms form colonies in which the fruit is all attached to the same mycelium mass. So if you're out there and you see one chanterelle, there's a really excellent chance that there's another or maybe another 20 within 50 feet of the one that you found. In fact, one of the largest living organisms on Earth is out in Montana. It's a tricholoma mushroom mass, and this thing covers square miles. So they can be quite large.
Wow, square miles. That's amazing. Here's a call from Peter in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Roger Finger.
Hi, I had a question. I missed a good part of the show, but I'm not sure. I heard you talking about Stamets, and I'm wondering if you have any comment on, I had a friend told me that that in one of his formulas he has cordyceps, and my friend was saying, and I give this formula to my kids, and this friend was saying cordyceps can cause DNA disruption. Wonder if you know anything about that, and then also maybe you already covered it, what things you can confuse for chanterelles.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sure. I'm going to have to probably punt on the cordyceps question. I have heard of them, and if I'm not mistaken, I think those are that's the fungus that feeds on insects, but I'd have to look that up. As far as chanterelles, there is one common mushroom that looks an awful lot like a chanterelle and is not edible. It's called gomphus. It's also orange, so you get pretty excited when you see these things. But then when you get up close to it, you'll notice that the center of the mushroom is conical and the stem is hollow. So it's little differences like that that make all of the difference between something that's edible and something that's a lookalike.
When it comes to edibles, I wonder if you have, in the last 25 years, Roger, bought mushrooms out of a store, or if it's always got to be something that came from the woods.
Oh, I have no objection at all to buying mushrooms in the store, and I frequently do. It depends on the season, for one thing. When we're out of season in the woods, you can still find dried mushrooms in the store, and those are excellent. And one of my favorite mushrooms is the shiitake, which in some areas is a wild mushroom, but not in ours. So if you want shiitake, you've got two choices. You can propagate them yourself, which involves some knowledge and some patience and some materials, or you can buy them from the store. So there are examples where I definitely will buy mushrooms rather than search them out.
We have another call here from a long way off from our home base anyway. Laura in Oregon City, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Roger Finger.
Hi. I was going to ask about the harvesting seasons and the best temperatures for harvesting.
Okay. Good questions there. Thanks for those. So, best harvesting seasons, best temperatures.
Well, of course, the fall is the major productive time of the year, rather than specify it in terms of date, we typically look at rainfall. So if we're getting rain in August, there's a pretty good chance that there'll be a flush of chanterelles out at the coast. But recently we had some really cold weather in the Willamette Valley, and that pretty much put an end to the season as far as chanterelles are concerned. The next big season is going to be in the spring, when things like morels and oyster mushrooms are common. But you can find mushrooms any time of the year. For example, right now, south of Eugene down to Redmond is the time of year when you're likely to find hedgehogs and black trumpet mushrooms. So people are out in the woods all year long, and some times of year are much more productive than others.
Does it take a fairly refined palate to taste differences between mushrooms? I mean, you know, when you're growing up as a kid, it's like, bleh, mushrooms. I don't want those on the pizza. But, you know, as you get older, it seems like you can appreciate them in the first sense, but then also get to know them as distinct from one another.
Mm-hmm. Definitely so. And I'll give two really extreme examples. The lobster mushroom is quite a large mushroom. It's kind of lumpy, and the surface of it is bright red because it's actually a parasitic infection of Arusula mushroom. So they have a faint taste of seafood. As they become older and a little more rotten, that smell becomes more pronounced, and then what you've got in your hand is slimy dead fish. But when they're fresh, they're very crisp and have a wonderful firm taste. Now, the second example is the matsutake, which has this unique smell, a little bit like cinnamon and cloves. And if you were to put that into a soup or into steamed rice, it would fill the entire kitchen with this lovely aroma. It's not subtle. It may be an acquired taste, but there are definitely differences between mushrooms.
Is there a particular recipe you're most fond of? I mean, the one thing you come back to over and over again in cooking mushrooms.
Well, I can give you the basic mushroom cooking recipe is to heat up a frying pan, put in a small amount of oil, and then chop up your mushrooms, put them in there, and what you'll find is most mushrooms will drop some water as they start to cook. You don't want to boil them. That'll make them soft and mushy. If you decant the water and continue cooking them for a bit longer, you'll get these nice, meaty, flavorful mushrooms that can then be put into stews and ragouts and risottos and egg dishes and just about anything you can dream of.
Any close calls you've had over the years where you got something into your kitchen and you thought, you know, I'm really not sure about this one?
I did have only one, and that was with one of those gilled mushrooms. It's an agaricus, and this one was the yellow-staining agaricus, which to me looked a bit like the meadow mushroom. But as soon as I got it into the pan, it put up a smell. It's kind of a chemical smell, and I knew right away that that was not something I was going to be eating tonight.
And we're not messing around here. I mean, when you get toxins out of a mushroom, it can be, we're talking seriously deadly. And not in a long period of time either.
Well, actually, the mechanisms of mushroom poisoning are quite varied, and some of them are quite frightening. Some mushrooms are hemolytic, that is, they will destroy red blood cells. Other mushrooms have neurological toxins, they'll attack the nervous system. Some mushrooms will attack the liver, and there's stories about immigrants who saw something that they recognized from the old country, but it turned out to be not what they thought, and they needed new livers. I'd say a greater number of mushrooms are just the kind that are going to give you a stomach ache. They're going to make you sick. They might make you vomit. They might make you sweat. It's going to be very unpleasant, but chances are that you'll survive the encounter.
All right. Well,
nonetheless, I wouldn't ask anybody to chance it.
Okay. Exactly the advice we're looking for at the end there. Roger Finger, we really enjoyed the visit with you. Thanks so much for joining us today to talk about mushrooms.
You're most welcome.
Roger Finger from the Oregon Mycological Society. That'll do it for today's exchange. You can find out more about the program online at jeffexchange.org. Look for us on Facebook and Twitter as well. The Exchange is produced by Charlotte Dern of JPR News. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Please have a great day.